This is Vectis Radio.
For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Paul Bradley, who describes himself as a man of many talents. Welcome, Paul.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
And you also are a self-confessed eccentric.
Well, yes. I'm English, so most of us are eccentrics.
And now you were telling me earlier that that's something that's come about slightly later in life, that when you were younger, you were a little bit more conformist. What do you think was the trigger?
Well, I think I was conformist because I grew up in the 50s and there were expected behaviours from you as a child, literally seen but seldom heard. And as I grew older, then I suppose the big stage was moving from a private junior school to a grammar school, and then all of a sudden that opens your eyes because you're no longer top of the pack and you are a poor little first year sitting in the corner shivering trying to avoid the prefects.
I think we can all relate to that one, yeah. Because you were you came from the city, didn't you? You've now moved to Bryston here on the Isle of Wight.
That's right. I was born and brought up in West London, and we moved to the Isle of Wight 7 years ago.
Would you say that was an eccentric move, from moving from London like
Oh,
that?
Quite definitely. I mean, I lived in West London. When I got married, we first house was in West London, out near Heathrow Airport. And then when we had children, we moved out to Hertfordshire, but not too far, only Watford, which is just over the border of Greater London. So I've always lived in West London. And I've worked in London. I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later. All my life. So to move to the Isle of Wight was a big step, and it actually happened extremely quickly as well, so I didn't really have much time to think about it.
And are you as much in love with the Isle of Wight as the rest of us?
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, it's chalk and cheese, don't get me wrong. I loved London. A lot of people don't like London. I was brought up there, and I know it very well. But I can also understand that for people who weren't brought up in a big city or London, it's very intimidating.
And what is it about our beautiful island that you personally love the most?
Well, when I was in London, we always used to talk about going to the seaside. And I think my family would relate to, if the sun was out and it was a Saturday morning, it was, let's go to the seaside. Well, now I don't have to go to the seaside because I actually live at the seaside. And the island itself is fantastic. I mean, they call it a microcosm of England. And it is. You've got a bit of beaches, you've got some forests, heathland. Whatever you feel like doing, you're no further than sort of half an hour, 45 minutes from going and doing it.
I think that what you've just said about when you live in a city and there's this wonderful expectation the minute the sun comes out that you want to go to the sea, even if you can't get there for whatever reason. Usually I was stuck at school or stuck in an office. And that glorious moment where it was decided that that's how you were going to spend the day, never mind the fact that most of that was spent on a motorway in the, you know, sort of sweating cobs, but it didn't matter because it was worth it for however long you got on the beach. So now you live by the beach. Do you spend lots of time down there?
Perversely, no.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, I think it follows. I'm sorry to keep going back to the London example, just as a comparison, but I worked 10 minutes away from the Houses of Parliament and Westminster Abbey.
Right.
I have never been in Westminster Abbey, and I walk past it every day. So I think you become a bit blasé, and living in Bryston down by the coast, it's there, it's great. Yes, we go down and walk the dog. But I think we've come a bit blasé about being able to get down there in 5 minutes. But never blasé about what's down there.
Yes.
Love the sea. People say, oh, the sea is the sea. It isn't. It has moods. You see so many different types of sea, calm, rough, but just the light on the water as well.
Yeah,
it's so just fantastic.
Time of day, weather, tide.
Yeah.
Everything changes, doesn't it? Number of people down there, who's down there, what they're doing. Yeah, it's an ever-changing landscape, which is just... I don't think I realised that when I was younger, but then I suppose I went to places like Brighton that tend to be very similar, conditions, don't they? I was either grey or blue down there, I think, but it's very different down here. It's very, very beautiful.
But it's landscape as well as the sea, and the actual location. I mean, living on the West Wight, which we've done, we find fantastic. And I don't know whether it's true, but a lot of people who come to the Isle of Wight tend to go to Ryde, Shanklin, Sandown, Ventnor. Brilliant. No, I'm not knocking that at all. But very few of them venture to the West Wight. And when they do, I've talked to people in the village who are visiting, and they say they've been coming to the Isle of Wight for years and never come over to the west and realise what they're missing.
Yeah, I mean, we've got that wonderful military road, haven't we, that runs the length almost of the south coast, and it is just, well, certainly to St Catherine's Point there and all the way from Freshwater Bay. It's just outstanding, isn't it? And people have likened it to the Garden Way, I think it is, in South Africa. It's so stunning. And you mentioned light there when you were talking about the changing look of the beach and the feel of the beach. You spoke about the different light, and perhaps not many people notice that. You're a very keen photographer, aren't you? A prize-winning photographer. So here must open up a world of possibilities.
Well, it does. I mean, the essence of photography is light. And it's not just photography, it's painting. If you go back to Monet, he bought the house at Giverny when he was getting older and laid it out as he wanted. And then depending on the light conditions and what flowers were actually out at a particular time, all he had to do was to walk into his garden. And that's why he's taken lots of paintings of water lilies and things like that. But then you think, oh, well, that's another water lily. But it's all down to the light. And it doesn't matter how many times you go down to Hanover Point or Totland or places like that, it's always different. I mean, even on a stormy day, and you see the black clouds rolling in off the sea, and the shafts of light that are playing, there's a proper name for them, but I can't remember. But anyway, I'm too busy taking pictures, because it's changing all the time, and that's really what you want in a photograph. It's the light that does it. You can have a brilliant subject, but you need the light, and probably a little bit of skill as well, I would say.
Do you have a favourite time, you know, a favourite light that really works for you?
For me, I like evening light. I mean, talking about going back again to when we used to go to the seaside, for a colloquial name, coming home through Sussex on the summer's evening, about 8 o'clock, and the sun coming through the trees and the sparkle and this yellow golden light. And it's that yellow golden light that I think it's my favourite type of light, and you can get that capture that in a photograph quite easily, and it's a beautiful time of day. You've got directional light as well, whereas at midday it's directly overhead. So I think, to answer your question, it's probably the golden hour, as they call it, in the evening, but in the summer's evening.
And what about a subject? Is it landscape or portraiture? What's your thing?
Anything. Anything at all. I suppose that heads into eccentricity as well. But if we're talking about normal photographic subjects, I'm a bit quirky, and I do sort of strange things for record purposes, which maybe we can talk about in a minute. But from landscape point of view, yes, I can't resist, again, light. And it's not necessarily a sunset. I like sort of breaking a few rules, like taking pictures directly into the sun to get silhouettes and things like that, and strange effects. And digital photography has really helped with that, because in the old days, when you had when you had film and that sort of thing, you were looking at to see how many of your 36 you were going to take.
Yeah.
But now you can just be experiment, you can do whatever you like and bash off 200, and then when you get home, there's a little icon at the top that says trash, which is exceedingly useful.
So how does your camera club, because I know you're involved with the camera club at Knighton, does the camera club look upon this rule breaking? This rebellious side of your nature, Mr. Bradley?
Well, that's a very good question. I think every photographer has their own style, and it would be very remiss to say that one is better than another, because different effects, it would be very boring, bluntly, if everybody took the same sort of photos. I think there's definitely an issue of, for a photograph to get notice and have that zing effect, to make it really stunning and to make something a bit different. And that's why you need to break some rules sometimes. Not everyone does it. Typically in a photo club, you'll get a lot of traditionalists who still bemoan the lack of dark rooms and things like that. And that's they've got their place. I mean, I came up on slides, and I took a long time to move to digital because I didn't believe in it. But now I've got it, I think it's got a lot of advantages. But I'm still not convinced that it has the same sort of saturation and quality that some of the prints or slides did in the old days. So I think the club any club is made up of individuals who do lots of different things. And I think you've got to respect that. And taking different things is what it's all about, so that you can inspire your colleagues.
And I know your wife, Norma Bradley, who was a guest on this show recently, is also a keen photographer and a prize-winning photographer. So do you find there's a lot of competitiveness between the pair of you?
Yes, to a certain degree, certainly. I mean, I think Norma's photography, she doesn't take as many pictures of me as me. In fact, quite often, she doesn't take a camera, which is absolutely astounding. But then, on the other hand, she says, well, I've got my mobile phone, which is something I sort of forget about, really, because my mobile phone has got a torch on it, and that's about it. Yes, she I think, is more measured in the photos she takes. She probably takes less and uses the old skills that I was alluding to when film was quite expensive, was to take a lot more time looking at the subject and then taking your picture, weighing it up, and not relying on mucking about with computers afterwards. So I think she's a little bit more measured. There is a bit of a rivalry, particularly with things like the Village Show, and there's another one coming up soon, so I'll have to watch myself. And she certainly has a big smug look on her face when she walks off with something, and I haven't.
So when that moment happens, how does that affect married life?
Not at all.
No?
No, not at all, because I just ignore her.
Oh, and is that the norm then, you ignoring her?
Yeah, and she ignores me when I win. We ignore each other before the pictures go in, because we don't look at each other's and see what each other's done. Occasionally she'll say, oh, you've stolen my photo. But generally we ignore it. The only time there's a little bit of ha-ha-ha and antagonism is when we actually go and see what the result is.
Right. Okay. And would you go so far as to maybe one year just not enter because you just don't want to go through all that hassle?
No, I think it's... I mean, I enjoy entering the photographs. I enter photographs into Village shows, to be honest with you. I haven't entered sort of national competitions or anything like that.
Why is that?
Time, really, and it's a step up. It's a step up. To get accredited and to really start to regularly produce photos, not just the one-offs that you've been extremely fortunate and lucky with, which I have been on a few individuals, but to do it consistently and to produce portfolios is another thing altogether. And to reach the sort of standard that national competitions are now demanding is, to be honest with you, I don't have the number of hours in the day. And the other thing is that photographs now at that sort of salon level and things like that are getting perilously close, in my opinion, to not being photographs at all.
How would you define them?
Well, they're works of art created on a computer from a basic image. And there's so many tools that add this, that and the other, effects and this sort of thing, that it's really a photographer is a painter using a computer in a lot of cases.
When you see an image, could you tell the difference between an image that was a pure photograph, if you like, that hadn't been photoshopped or enhanced in any way, and one that had? Or is there a very fine line?
Nowadays, no, I don't think you can.
Right.
Because I think, I'm a photographic judge for the Southern Counties Federation, and I think these days, because the tools exist, you have to assume that people are using them. Even on something that looks like a basic landscape or a bit of street art, you've got to assume that something's been fiddled with it. And if photographers get upset by saying, oh, it's just a straight image, that doesn't really count anymore. It may be a straight image, but unfortunately you're up against a load of other images that you've got to assume have been worked to the ends of the earth, basically.
Right. This is possibly why I look slightly better in my, well, a lot better in my wedding photos than I do normally, because I do remember the photographer saying to me, because I said, oh, can I see them? And she said, not yet, I haven't finished working on them. And now I know kind of what she was doing, God love her. She was taking out all the crow's feet and the alleged laughter lines.
Well, they used to call it dodging. And I mean, nowadays the computer images can be done with Photoshop or whatever the other software is easily to do. But let's not delude ourselves. People who did prints worked on them forever
Oh, of course.
To get the right sort of blacks and whites or tints and taking out obstructions. So there was a lot of darkroom work done.
A lot of retouching, yeah.
But they would have struggled a bit to take out a sky dish, put it like that.
Indeed, yeah. Not that there was a sky dish to be taken out in those days. Yeah, everything's changed.
Good point made.
You've got, I mean, you've just got a list here about a dozen interests and passions.
Only a dozen.
I would say, yeah, and I'm sure there's things you haven't told me about. And at the top of the list, I've got something here called bacon butties.
Mm.
And it's not just that you like to eat them, it's a group, isn't it?
Well, Norma says I shouldn't eat bacon butties, so it's a bit perverse, really. Mm. So maybe bacon butties are set up so I could eat bacon butties. This came about first time I heard about it was at Shorewell. And they were holding a regular monthly session for, and it was called Blokes, Banter and Butties. And there was a need identified that there's plenty around for women's groups and for women to get together and discuss things, but very little for chaps. And you're talking about blokes who've retired, maybe on their own anyway, but anyway, in a village and not a great deal to do. And really their circle of friends will be the people that they know. So this was set up to bring people together in a relaxed atmosphere and just let it run and see what they talk about.
So is it a bit like an old-fashioned mother's meeting with men?
Never been to a mother's meeting.
Excellent answer. Okay.
I think from what I've heard, men talk about different things to women.
Well, we'll never know, will we? Because never the twain shall meet at these things.
Well, we have had interlopers with women who've been come in and been very embarrassed and disappeared again. But they were only visiting. But it's interesting that when she arrived, the conversation changed completely. So they obviously weren't they're comfortable to talk. Men are comfortable to talk about things to other men, maybe because it's on a higher plane, you know.
I don't know what you mean by
no,
that.
No, I'm sure you don't.
No.
And it's blokes talk, and that's really what it's about.
But what is blokes talk? I remember when I started dating, and I used to think that that was probably the secret of a very happy relationship, if I could just crack that, because I didn't know what men spoke about. Clearly still don't. What do you talk about then?
Well, on the island, it's basically farming experiences that they've had way back, some of them during the war. And just sharing stories of a lot. The thing about the island as well is that a lot of the chaps here have grown up on the island and probably grew up in the same sort of circles. They played for the same village team. You know, they went to the same pubs. They went to the same schools, which I didn't. They've got that they will talk about. Or more recently, their interests. And a lot of them have got these. You've heard of men in sheds.
Yes, I have.
Well, every man who's worth his salt has got a shed, and no one's allowed in there, and it's a secret. But if they get stuck, then people will ask about how do you do this or how do you do that, and it's really that's the sort of thing that will go on. But it's just anything, really. I mean, I would be lying if I said that Donald Trump hasn't been mentioned a couple of times, or any other things that are going on in the world. And everyone's allowed to express their own opinions. And what's raised at Bacon Butties stays in Bacon Butties.
I see. So it sounds to me like you steer very clear of any emotional issues.
Yes, I think so. You might note that old George has passed on, or did you hear that so-and-so has gone, you know, but... It's. I suppose it's a gathering of local news as well, but with a slant.
It is different, though, isn't it? And I suppose you wouldn't call any of this gossiping.
Well, far from it. No.
Okay.
No.
As you said, it's on a much higher plane.
It's much higher plane.
We've established that.
So it's almost theological.
Who does the cooking? Who fries up these bacon butties?
Well, now, this may come as a shock to the female listeners, but the blokes do the cooking. And my colleague, Bob Sturgis, he has got one of these, well, I call them George Formby grills, but they're actually the George Foreman. And we've got an enormous thing.
I wonder what you can say then.
This cooks bacon, this one. That's where the bacon gets cooked. So it's high tech, bung it on, sizzle it until it smokes, out it comes. And I do the teas. And the teas and coffees. I'm multi-skilled now. I can do coffee as well as tea. We haven't gone as far as decaf yet, but we're running.
I don't hear the word cake mentioned.
No cake. This is bacon butties. This is in the morning. And it's bacon roll. We're very haute cuisine. We've got tomato and brown sauce, both of them.
I don't know why the morning precludes cake, Paul. Sorry, you're talking to the wrong person there.
Well, I suppose it's like not having a drink before the sun's over the yardarm, or what are they doing in the Navy?
Make these silly
rules. You can't have cake in the morning, not unless Norma's made it.
Well, indeed. So does Norma kind of... She doesn't help?
No, she stays well clear. Well clear.
Wise woman by the sound of it. So is anything, are you going to... It sounds like it could be interesting, though, these stories of an island past and lives lived. It would be very interesting to collate some of them. Is that on your plans?
It's not on my plans. It's an interesting thought, though. I often think about going back in time myself and hearing my relatives talking about things. And at the time, when we were little, we giggled in the corner and said, oh, Auntie Gwen's off again, you know, all this sort of thing. But as it turned out, a lot of what they said is irreplaceable now.
Of course, and yet, like you say, it is that callousness of youth that we just deride it, we close our ears and we go and do something that we think is far more interesting.
Well, I'm on the receiving end now, of course.
Yes.
You know, the youth of today... And the young policeman, you know, everything's changed, and what we did, no one seems to be interested in.
And we're standing really in our parents' shoes in that sense.
Absolutely,
aren't
we? And it's frightening because all of a sudden, I mean, my parents had a mortgage, you know. Then I've got a mortgage, and now my kids have got a mortgage, you know. So,
right. Well, I think that's a really good place to take a break. And when we come back afterwards, I want to hear about all these other eccentric pastimes and your life in London, because you worked for the London Underground. There's lots to be spoken about there. I'm sure you've got some wonderful stories. So please stay tuned. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back straight after this break.
Stay social and get in touch. It's at Vectis Radio on Twitter. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to Wit Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest, Paul Bradley, a man of many talents and self-confessed eccentric. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you.
Before the break, we touched on your life in London, and you worked for London Underground. You know, you were at the heart of it, weren't you? And you trained to drive a Route Master, one of the big red London buses. You went out on the skid pad. That must have... You've got some stories to tell.
Well, yes. I mean, I wasn't a bus driver, let me say straight away. Mm. I joined London Transport from school, mainly because... Well, it was rather strange, because it was a local company. It was in Chiswick, and I lived in Brentford, in West London, so it's fairly adjacent. So I thought, well, that's nice and local. And a colleague of mine at school had recently joined doing something else. So I thought, oh, well, let's see what jobs they've got. Because when I left school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Absolutely no idea. I thought about the Navy and customs and excise, and my parents were desperate for me to be a dentist for some reason.
Were they desperate for you to go to university?
If they were, they were disappointed.
Right.
Because I didn't. It didn't feel right. I wanted to get out of school as quickly as possible and out of education. The other thing was, all my family, practically every generation, has been a teacher, so there was a lot of pressure on being teachers as well. Anyway, getting back to London Transport. So I joined something called the Supplies Management Training Scheme, which sounded very interesting. And basically, it was about stores and purchasing, buying. And I did a nearly a three-year, well, I suppose, apprenticeship on the training scheme. But at the same time, I went to college, so I didn't get away with not going to an educational establishment. So I had to learn. Get a professional qualification, which was the Institute of Purchasing and Supply. And I ended up with a degree in business studies. So actually, I have got a degree, but never been to university. And I think that's another eccentric thing that perhaps I've done it. If I'm going to do something, I always do it a different way. But it was really good, because London Transport, as it was in those days, was enormous. And it was almost like a microcosm of different activities. I mean, we even made our own food. We had our own food production factory down at Croydon. But what it did was introduce me, because you did a stint in each lots of different departments, to a wide range of disciplines, and most importantly, and this is something I think people miss out on these days, a wide range of people. So you were not only building up a basis of knowledge, but a basis of contacts. And some of those contacts went on for many, many years, and it was really, really useful.
So you learned the importance of networking early on there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And getting things done. And I think I was always known as someone who'd get something done. And a lot of that was knowing the right people to go to.
Which was a very good moniker to have, I imagine, at a big organisation like that.
It was. Throughout my life, I feel I've been overlooked and got a bit of a complex about it. I mean, I love sport. I played cricket at school. It took a long time to get into the cricket team. Football, the same. Maybe because of my very athletic figure.
Right.
Not. but same with London Underground. It was slow and steady, really. And I think I benefited from having more of a tortoise approach to life rather than the hare and building up the base knowledge. And worked my way through. I became a manager eventually. And I was some of the best days I had was a manager on the district line, responsible for all their materials, logistics on the district line.
So what the show is called Wick Wisdom and Pratfalls.
Yep.
And I have to ask you, what is your pratfall moment at London Transport? What was the one day or the one that you just thought, oh no, please let the ground open up and swallow me?
We'd been on a negotiation for, it was escalator parts actually, and we'd been up to Newcastle on the train, and let's just say it didn't go very well.
Right.
And the further we got on the train back at Newcastle, by Darlington I was dying, by York I was ready to jump off because it just didn't go very well, and I knew that I had to I was going to come back and say, and I hadn't got the deal that we wanted, basically. And it was, I take things very personally when things don't work out. And that took me quite a few weeks to get over.
But you survived that?
Yes, I think so. Yes.
But they didn't fire you?
No, not immediately. No.
So how many years were you there?
37.
Wow. So at the end of that, is it transport for life? Do you get a kind of pass that you just last forever in London, or don't they do that anymore?
No. Well, I do. I mean, when I joined, I got a ticket for the British Railways as well. In fact, mine had an F on it. Which meant ferries, so I could actually use it, and still can, on some of the Isle of Wight ferries.
So it was. Do you think that F on that ticket could have any role to play in the fact that you perhaps came here more often than most people, therefore got to love it?
No, not really. I mean, I did come to the Isle of Wight. Mm. The Isle of Wight really, there was quite a few things that happened with the Isle of Wight. Firstly, my sister-in-law, her came over, and her husband was working on the island, and they were living at Bembridge, and then they were followed by my mother-in-law, who came with them, so we used to come over and see them, and then subsequently they moved away, but then my daughter got married to Simon, who is a teacher now at the Priory at Whippingham.
Oh, right.
And they met at Southampton in a pub, I believe. Unusual.
Fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough. But they now live in East Cowes, so we used to come over and see them quite a lot. On top of that, I'm very interested in ice hockey at that time, and I used to go to, in London, I used to go and see Slough. And then one day they were playing a team from the island. So I thought, well, that's different. I didn't know they had a team. So I started looking at the island results and started supporting them more than the team in Slough. And the Isle of Wight team, whenever they were playing in London or thereabouts, I used to go. So there was a few years when I saw away games but had never seen a home game.
Right.
Never been to the island.
So it must have broke your heart when the rink closed.
Well, it did, yes. I mean, I did then start coming to home games. And then when we moved over here, I got quite heavily involved with it. In the supporters club, and I used to be responsible for tickets. And generally, it became a part of my life. And it became part of Norma's life as well, because it meant that she had Saturday evenings to watch whatever rubbish she wanted to.
Good for Norma.
Without me. But then all of a sudden, and I think this was the real thing, I mean, we had problems with the roof blowing off, and then we thought we'd got over that, and the roof was fixed, and then we there was
a
consortium. Sorry, this is at Ryde Arena, not at our house.
Yes.
Then all of a sudden, for whatever reasons, the rink was shut. I think we played at the weekend, and the rink was shut on the Tuesday. And it was so quick, even the players' kit was still in there. So, and since then, if you see anyone walking around, particularly the Ryde or Newport area, with sort of a vacant look on a Saturday evening, they were people who used to go to the hockey.
Have we lost it forever?
Oh, I hope not. I hope not. I mean, there's a lot of things going on. There was some news yesterday, apparently, that a dialogue has started up, which is good, because there hadn't been a dialogue before. I really hope not. And it's not just hockey. Let me say this straight away. It's a community activity. Ryde is a community asset. There are so many kids that were using the arena for ice skating, and people, I mean, it's one of the few things that the islands got was a rink, and there were a lot of really good skaters. I mean, we've got national championships, the girls have just come back, I think, from Dundee or somewhere, and they're having to practice in Guildford and Gosport and places like that at all times of the day because they haven't got any home ice. But these kids are still winning trophies. The little youngsters, I knew some youngsters who used to come to the rink, and they were, just before it folded, they were absolutely ecstatic that they got their first set of skates and their stick to whack each other with. Mm. And they were looking forward to playing for the youngster teams, and then everything stopped. And, you know, you wonder, it just, if you were really into something and someone took it away from you at that age, it's terrible, absolutely terrible.
It shows tremendous amount of dedication and commitment to train, not just to go for matches, but
the
to
people
train
that run
on the mainland.
The dancers, the people that run the skaters deserve medals for what they've done, and particularly in the adversity that we've had since the rink closed. And really, really hope that we get ice back on the island as soon as possible.
It didn't go without a fight, did it?
Well, no, but there's not a great deal you can do when the people you want to talk to won't talk to you.
Exactly.
And really even identifying who had actually done it and what their raison d'etre was. There didn't seem to be any logic to it at all. But let me get this straight, I'm not close to it. I'm like every other punter, I'm sort of a bit on the outside of what actually went on. But the bottom line is, and I believe in looking at the bottom line and the effect on people, is that ice rink was shut and people couldn't go down there anymore.
Which, like you say, it's a huge loss. But there's so many other things that you're involved with on the island, isn't there? I mean, there's the History Society, there's the Wilberforce Hall, there's a social club, there's the Isle of Wight Railway. I mean, you love all things railway, don't you? And I happen to know you've got a model railway, haven't you?
I have, yes, yeah. Yes.
And how much area, sort of your average living room space, say, how much of that does your model railway?
Well, I'm actually banned from the living room.
I would imagine.
Yes.
You are.
When we first got married,
with your trains?
No, with the spare. No, I'm talking about this with the. Well, no, no, careful. I had my railway in the spare bedroom, but then my wife got pregnant, and so we had to have the spare bedroom for the child. Sarah, my daughter.
You've had this model railway for
It goes back long, long time.
Goodness me.
So when we moved to the island, one of the conditions was I got a shed. And we're back to sheds again.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, this is 16 feet long.
Okay.
So it's 16 feet long, this shed, and gradually it's been built up. You never finish it. It's like the Forth Bridge. You're always doing bits and pieces to it, and then you see someone else's railway and think, oh, I haven't got one of those. I need to do something about that. So, but it's a bolt hole.
You get model railway envy.
I do, personally. Yes, I don't know whether others do, but I do. I think, oh, and that's what drives me. Whenever I try to do something, I like to be a perfectionist. I like to be the best in it. So it doesn't matter whether it's photography. If I take something on, like a model railway or something else, it's got to be right. It's got to be right.
And I don't know. Tell me, when you were a boy, did you play with trains then? Did you have a railway then, a model railway?
I did, but it wasn't. I got it for Christmas, and it was an occasional thing. I wasn't interested really in trains at all. The interest, I think, came out of my professional interest in public transport, to be honest. So it was quite late.
So when just you and your model railway, is it a little bit of a reflection of childhood? Is it that going back to boyhood and going back to no worries, no hassles, no stress, and just playing with trains?
I think it's going back to things that you couldn't have before, and now you can, and you can do whatever you like. And it's having that freedom to be able to do what you want to do. I think it manifests itself as well in people who have, for example, vintage cars.
Yes, I was just going to say, you know, that's another thing that you can actually, we can all do,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. People like, will go back. And that's why heritage is such a big thing. I mean, if you look at, for example, dinky toys or things like that, these are things that people may have wished they had or even had and were given away, like all mine were. And you want to relive those days,
yes,
and heritage, and bring back those memories of what I suppose people think are better times.
Because Rod Stewart's got a model railway, hasn't he?
Just a little one, yes, yes. He's got a flat in New York that's completely devoted to it.
And I know he used to have it in his loft. I mean, it wouldn't be a loft like I have, because I've got a teeny tiny loft, but it was in his loft when he was married to one of his ex-wives. And I think that, I believe that that railway added to the demise of that particular partnership.
Did it?
Yes.
Yes.
Are you surprised to hear that? I mean, would you think that you and Norma could come to blows over it?
No, I don't think so. No, she used to. In fact, I think it's a bit like going to ice hockey. I think she's pleased to see me disappear. We had an arrangement where there was a doorbell actually fitted in the shed, and she used to press the bell when it was mealtime. But that sort of gave way. I don't know whether I disconnected it or what. So now I just get a bellow out of the window whenever there's someone on the phone or
bellow
I'm
instead
required.
Of a bell.
Yes,
right.
or a rap. And I've been shouting at you for hours. Where are you?
So do you get friends round to play with it? Do you say you're playing with it? Is that the term you would use?
Modelling.
Oh, modelling.
Modelling.
Modelling,
yes.
In your shed.
Yes. I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I'm not proud, to be honest with you. Yeah, playing with the railway is fine. Play gives you an idea, sort of a feel of kids on a carpet with a circle of track. Mm. But it's a little bit more than that. I have some friends who have an interest as well, and we'll come round and have a look or whatever. But generally, it's me on my own. Yes.
And that's valuable time, by the sounds of
it. It is. Yes. It gives you time to think. Particularly of all the other jobs that Norma's got lined up for me, that I can just wait for a bit until I've finished doing this.
And do you make the models? Do you paint them?
A lot of them are what they call proprietary, so you buy them from a shop. But I do model. I've modelled since I was little with Airfix kits and things like that. But I do scratch build. And one thing you can't get is underground trains. So I've made underground trains for my layout. They don't actually go down tube tunnels under the garden or anything, but I've made those, yes.
Oh, I can see a whole new project there, Paul.
Yes.
No, that just, I don't know, there's something really delightful in it, isn't there? And please tell me that you love and use our own old, you know, what are they, Bakerloo lines that we have on the Isle of Wight?
They're old tube trains.
Yeah.
And there's a connection with me with those as well, actually, because one of my jobs at London Transport was in sales. So it was part of the same supplies department. And with sales, when you're buying something, you're trying to get it best value. You know, people think it's the cheapest, but it's best value. When you're selling something, you want to get as much money as possible for it. So that's what we were doing. And it just coincided with the old red tube trains that dated from 1938 coming up for disposal. And the Isle of Wight had what was called standard stock, which dates back to the 1920s. And they wanted more tube trains. The reason for that is the tunnel at Ryde Esplanade is too low for anything of normal gauge. Basically, it would hit it if it went through it.
Right.
So, and they wanted some red ones. So I wasn't actually the lead on that, but I was part of the team that actually arranged for the Isle of Wight to get trains. I had to go to a place at Eastleigh first to be converted and this sort of thing. But those, I have a link with those carriages coming to the island.
Oh, that's lovely. And that route, as I think most people know, runs from Ryde Pierhead through the Esplanade and lands up at Shanklin,
yep,
doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yep.
Do you, like me, kind of mourn the loss of the fact that we just don't have the steam railway network that the islands once boasted?
Well, I never knew it. I think you only mourn things that perhaps you knew. I don't really remember steam, apart from being taken up to Ealing Broadway and watching the Great Western steam trains and my grandfather poking me and saying, remember this, you won't see them again. But that's about it. So I'm not a great... I like steam, don't get me wrong. I enjoy steam, I like steam railways. I'm a great supporter of what's happening at Haven Street, which is absolutely fantastic. But I don't actually mourn steam because I don't think I ever remembered it.
I was thinking more of the actual transport network that just linked everywhere so beautifully, even the West Wight.
Well, the complexity, yes. Yeah. I think not just in the Isle of Wight, though, that did obviously affect it. But if you look now at the number of sizable places of population that used to have transport links, namely railways, that went, nowadays, I mean, some of them have been put back again. But you've got to live in the time. I don't go necessarily with people who rely on hindsight. You've got to live in your own time, and you've got to make decisions in your own time. Now, you may get some wrong, but at the time, it was the right thing to do.
Indeed, yes. You've got to stand by that, yeah. I think.
Which,
yes,
may sound like heresy for someone in the railways, but I think the problem was that when they were pruning the rows, they took the roots out as well.
Indeed. Very good, very good. I think that's an interesting thing that you say, you've got to live in your time. For somebody who is very much involved in the History Society, and you produced the World One book and a book about Bryston going back in time. So how do you rationalise those two thoughts?
Well, you live in your own time, but you can still respect what happened before and be interested in the way people used to live. I mean, the origins of the First World War book, which is about all the chaps in Bryston who went to the First World War, really came out of the fact that my grandfather was in the First World War, not on the Isle of Wight, but he was, and it just wanted to sort of have a sort of acknowledgement and do something to respect him and my other grandfather, who was in the Navy in the First World War, respect what they actually did. I mean, they never told me about it. They never recounted anything about it. And we lived very near to the war memorial in Bryston, and it had these names on there. And so I thought, oh, well, I know. I'll research them and find out what they did. And then I thought, well, why should it just be them? What about the others that went but were fortunate not to be killed? So it expanded to about 90-odd names. And then I did research, and I got some real help from the County Records Office, Richard Smout and people like that, and started looking at the county press and thing and all these sources. And we ended up with over 100. I think it was about 112 of these people, men. Well, not all men. There was one woman as well, who actually went to the First World War. And so it was my sort of bit to record what they'd done from Bryston, and for the future, so that people, they wouldn't be forgotten on their sacrifice.
And that book is still available, isn't it?
It is, yes.
People from, want to buy a copy? Where do
yeah, it's available now from Bryston Library.
Brilliant. Okay. And is there anything online?
No, there's nothing online. No.
Okay. And you're talking about the past there and the future. You're a father of two, a boy and a girl.
Yep.
And obviously, as you said, they've grown up now, they've got their own lives and their own careers. But what advice, and I know our children never listen to us, but if they did, what would be the piece of advice you most hope to pass on to them?
Oh dear, that's put me on a spot, especially as she's probably listening. I think just be integrity. Be truthful with yourself and everybody else. Live your life as you want to. By all means, express yourself and put your mark on society. Don't follow a mould. I mean, that was the danger I had from my youth, that there was a mould that was being set for me, but I didn't follow it and I did other things. And really, to do whatever you want to do. Don't necessarily be an anarchist or anything like that, but just slightly have a little bit of an edge of nonconformity, I think, and do what you want. Life's short enough. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm sitting here and I'm retired, and I'm thinking, well, what happened to that lot? You know, where are we going here?
But in terms of your life has passed very quickly, looking back?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Mm. I mean, it seemed to last forever until about 30. And then all of a sudden, whoom, and it was, you know, sort of now in my 60s. So, all right, still a youngster, I suppose, in modern day, but don't think it's going to be like it forever. You've just got to do what you want to do today to go places. A good example, I have never flown. I've never flown in an aeroplane, and I've got a bit of a, because I never did, I've got a bit of a stigma about it. And now I don't think I'll ever fly because I'm petrified of it.
Right.
But I made sure that my children went on school trips on an aeroplane. My son went to Canada, and my daughter has been on school trips to Israel and places like that. And they were. I made it. It was important that they flew. so they wouldn't have that stigma.
And when they're in the air, are you worried witless over them?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
No, I'm very selfish. It's just me that I'm worried about as far as sitting in aeroplanes concerned.
And you wouldn't go on one of these courses that helps you through that?
Well, no. I mean, that's what Norma keeps going on about. But you say I'm an eccentric. I've actually been on Concorde, but never flown. Because when I was on the London Transport, we had an exchange with British Airways, and we went to Heathrow Engineering Exchange. And they said, would you like to come over and go on an aeroplane? So we drove across the tarmac at Heathrow, and the aeroplane they chose was Concorde. So we actually went on it, sat in the cockpit, and they shut the door. And all of a sudden, I wasn't very happy.
I was going to say, that was horrible.
But then I've been in tube trains and things like that, and no problems at all, but I wasn't happy. But it's so small inside, and there was a chap banging the tail with a rubber hammer. I remember he was on some scaffolding hitting the tail with a rubber hammer, and they had drip trays underneath with oil and everything. And then this chap comes along and said, right, lads, sorry, he said, we've got to get off. This is the 5:30 to New York.
Where do you think that phobia comes from?
Not doing it earlier, not having the opportunity to. That's why I say opportunities. Mm. Take your opportunities. My parents weren't great travellers. I think my mother only flew a few years before her death, when she went to Canada because she wanted to see the Rocky Mountains. But and my father was in the RAF, so I'm not sure whether he actually flew professionally because he was ground crew, but he never flew, in my knowledge, ever. So there wasn't the opportunity to fly. And it just became I hadn't done it, and it just became a stigma. And I had no drive to want to go to. I lacked drive as far as going to foreign places. I've been to Venice and places like that, but we went by train, you know. So I suppose I'm limited by train activity.
And because I suppose you have an extreme interest in it, don't you? I mean, it is a big passion of yours. When I think of you, that's what I think of.
What, trains?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It was my job.
So is there any train like the Orient Express or something like that you'd long to go on that you haven't been on?
No, not really, because I know that it's something I can't achieve because I'd have to fly to get there. I suppose the one across Australia, I think it's called the GAN, that runs right across Australia would be something to say you'd done. But my aspirations were quite modest. I mean, my bucket list included going to Kyle of Loch Alsh, mainly because the station name's so long. And we did that. We went out and we got that, and that's fantastic. Or going out to Fort William or someone like that, you know.
What have you got left to do on your bucket list?
Well, I think it's a difficult one, really, on things. What Norma tells me to do, I suppose. But
we really should have had Norma on together with you, I think, because that's another show. And
she's been on once already. Can't have it every week.
No, but I think we want one with the pair of you, because I think that could be quite interesting. A very good
I don't think we'd be as open.
Well, maybe Norma would.
Yes. I wouldn't get a word in anyway.
So, your children, what do you think, you know, when they think of you as dad? Because it's very hard for us as parents to put ourselves in our children's shoes, I think, isn't it? And we know how we see ourselves. But how do you think, for example, your son would describe you?
I think he would get very exasperated about some of the things that I do. Hopefully, he can recognise that I'm there if I need him. Sorry, he needs me. And vice versa, I suppose, actually, having made that slip. What could you? Sorry, repeat the.
I just wondered how they would see you, how they'd describe you.
I think they would. I think it's the only experience I've got of that is things, the way I react to things. Like they used to come and watch me play cricket, and they never used to bother watching me back because I was always back so quickly that they used to say, "Oh, he's out again. He's in. He's out." So I think they'd probably remember that. But hopefully, they took some pride in the fact that I was part of a national institution, which London Underground was. I mean, they've had opportunities to do things that probably other kids haven't, which hopefully they would remember. For example, going in the front of a train or going even underneath a train. And this is not when it was running along, incidentally. I wasn't trying to get rid of them. They weren't tied up at the time. Hopefully they would say that I've got some morals and standards and Generally a good person, yes.
A man of integrity.
Yes, hopefully a good person.
Yeah. As your advice would be to them.
Yes.
So, well, I think that's certainly how I'd describe you, Paul, as a man of great integrity, which sadly is a trait that's, I think, quite lacking in this day and age, I'm sorry to say. But it's been lovely sharing this hour with you, and thank you so much for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, and nice to talk to you as well.
Thank you, Paul Bradley. And thank you for listening. Please join me next week when my special guest will be Aushi Vilas, who is, again, she's a keen photographer, and she's a professional photographer, and she's a bit of a miracle worker with that lens. So do join in and have a little look at what she's capable of online, because, like I say, she has some very beautiful portraiture. Thank you for listening. Have a lovely weekend. Take care. Bye bye now.
www.vectisradio.com